The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program...
So Egypt feels like it's built the canal in blood, paid for it in blood, and yet isn't able to get the revenue from the canal.
The Suez Crisis, the war over a canal that hastened the end of British imperialism in Egypt. Also...
So they say they have been obliged to pawn their day and night covering to provide food and are now suffering from cold and hunger, too much for human endurance.
The Distress Papers, the archive collection which reveals the people and stories behind the grim statistics of the famine. Plus...
It's almost impossible to get at the real Parnell at this stage. I mean, he's overlaid by so many echoes and so many projections.
Parnell and His Times, a major new book that reevaluates the nationalist leader's impact on Ireland. But to begin this evening... sound there of the dredging crew celebrating the successful Suez refloating operation earlier this week. The container ship, the Ever Given, was freed on Monday after running aground in high winds and spending 6 days diagonally wedged in the Suez Canal. This event highlighted the waterway's importance to global supply chains. It brought a major portion of the world's seaborne trade to a standstill as hundreds of ships were either stuck in traffic or forced to reroute. Since it was completed in 1869, the Suez Canal has been one of the world's most important bodies of water, a portal between East and West, vital to global trade. Some called last week's incident the new Suez Crisis, but it was nothing compared to the original Suez Crisis in 1956, when Britain, France and Israel invaded Egypt to fight for control of the canal. To talk about this, I'm joined now by Dr. Hussein Omar, lecturer in modern global history at University College Dublin. Hussein, you're very welcome to The History Show.
Thank you.
Now, the crisis was sparked when President of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, nationalized the canal. Tell us a little bit about Nasser, a kind of legendary figure in global history, and his rise to power in Egypt.
So Nasser was the humble son of a postman. He's born in 1918, towards the end of the First World War. He's named Jamal after Jamal Pasha, the commander of the Ottoman army at the time. And he is by all means very bright. He ends up in law school and he gets politicized in the 1930s when the very short-lived Egyptian democratic constitution is suspended under pressure from the occupying British forces. And he participates in a demonstration. He gets wounded. He spends a night in jail. And he's basically infuriated by the continued occupation of Egypt by Britain. And the continued occupation is after 1922, when Egypt is nominally given independence, centered around the Suez Canal itself, which the British had refused to cede control over. The Suez Canal is the reason, in some ways, that Britain occupies Egypt in the first place in 1882. Nasser is a law student in 1936, at the moment when the Anglo-Egyptian treaty is renegotiated, and it's seen by elite politicians as an attempt to give Egypt more freedom than it had previously been granted, but it doesn't go far enough for young men like Nasser. However, the Anglo-Egyptian treaty allows Egyptians to enroll in the military academy for the first time since the 1880s, something that had really been prohibited by Britain. So Nasser leaves law school and he joins the military academy, energized, radicalized. He may or may not have been a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, an organization which emerges around the Suez Canal, very much in opposition to the continued colonization of Egypt. He also joins forces with a group called Young Egypt, a group of quasi-fascist leanings that understood that making an alliance with Germany against Britain might be beneficial to Egypt's interests, a story that is, of course, familiar here in Ireland. Nasser is part of a group of military officers that, after an accelerating amount of tension between Britain and Egypt in 1952, launch a coup to depose the king of Egypt. And they do so by taking over the radio and simply making an announcement that he was deposed. And it comes off the back of a bloody event in which quite a lot of Egyptian police officers are killed by British gunfire in January of 1952, January 25th, which is then declared Police Day, which is also the day that was chosen for the start of the protests in 2011, which are protests against the Egyptian police. In 1952, Nasser is very much in the background. He's not yet in the lead. The man leading the revolution, as it were, is a more senior military figure called Mohammed Naguib. But Nasser has every intention of overthrowing Naguib, which he's plotting to do behind the scenes. There's an attempt on Nasser's life in 1954 by the Muslim Brotherhood, which he then uses as an excuse to quash all dissent and to come to power. So in 1956, when he nationalizes the canal, Nasser is part of an emerging constellation of forces that are competing for power, and arguably it is through the nationalization of the canal that Nasser secures his place as the leading figure of Egyptian, Arab, and indeed Third World politics in the mid-1950s.
Now, 1956, we're very much in the middle of the Cold War, but Nasser is somebody who, on the face of it at least, espouses non-alignment, isn't he?
Yes, absolutely. There are all sorts of rumors, however, that the Free Officers, of which Nasser was a part, was a kind of CIA-sponsored operation. And indeed, it's really in the beginning of the 1950s, it's unclear which way Egypt will go. The USSR at this point is supportive of Israel, which was established in 1948. France is the leading exporter of arms to Israel. The United States and Egypt have a closer relationship at that point than you might think. The lines aren't really set. The US has offered at this point to give Egypt a loan via the World Bank to build a dam in Aswan, the southernmost town in Egypt on the Nile, which would, on the one hand, provide Egypt with hydropower, but would also regulate the flooding of the Nile, which was really essential to Egypt's agricultural economy. There is a back channel attempt by the Americans to forge some kind of peace between Israel and Egypt in 1955. Egypt says they are willing to, or Nasser says he is willing to, provided that the U.S. supply him with unlimited arms, something that they are unwilling to do. And it's the kind of the fallout from these failed negotiations in 1955 that leads Nasser to think that if he is unable to secure a loan via the World Bank, that he has to nationalize the Suez Canal in order to be able to divert the income from the canal to the building of the dam, which is already underway. Meanwhile, Nasser is also buying arms from the USSR via Czechoslovakia, and that allows him to maintain the fiction of non-alignment, which, as time goes on, will appear to be increasingly a fiction.
So is the motivation then for nationalizing the Suez Canal primarily economic, or is it political?
Well, it's both. So as I said, the Suez Canal is both a symbol and the real material reason that Egypt gets incorporated into the British Empire by illegal occupation in 1882. It's when Egypt defaults on a set of loans that Britain uses that as a loans that had been taken in order to pay for the canal, that Britain uses as an excuse to occupy Egypt. So until there is a total evacuation of British troops from the canal zone, Egypt cannot be considered to be sovereign. So there is that. The building of the canal comes at an enormous cost. In, I think, one of the most recent estimates, it says up to 1 million Egyptian men were conscripted into the labor corps that built the canal, and I think casualties have been estimated to be as many as 100,000. So Egypt feels like it's built the canal in blood, paid for it in blood, and yet isn't able to get the revenue from the canal. The occupation of Egypt was both economic and political, and the two cannot actually be separated, either in the history of the colonization of Egypt. The financialization of the British Empire really kind of reaches its zenith in Egypt as this new kind of experimental colonial space, and in the attempt to reclaim sovereignty through taking back the canal, as it were.
And then what's the political and military response immediately to Nasser's nationalization of the canal?
So Nasser's nationalization of the canal is done in code. In a famous speech that is aired on the radio, he utters the words Ferdinand de Lesseps, which is the name of the engineer who built the canal. He is the first cousin of the Empress Eugenie, the wife of Napoleon III. He had been there had been an enormous statue of him in the canal zone, which is subsequently brought down very violently. Again, a theme that is familiar to us thinking about memorialization today. And the uttering of the word Ferdinand de Lesseps is the code for the Egyptian military to move in on the canal zone. Nasser had restricted access to the canal prior to that by closing the Straits of Senefir, which are further south to the canal. So it's where the kind of southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula is. So he effectively blocks off the Red Sea opening of the canal to Israeli ships, therefore preventing them from getting any Red Sea access via their port in Eilat. So he'd done that in 1950. It was understood to be in contravention of the Constantinople Treaty of 1888, which gave the right of passage to ships of all nationalities, regardless of political alignment. Now, he had blockaded the passage of Israeli ships on the grounds that they didn't recognize Israel and therefore didn't recognize Israeli nationality in the first place, and therefore they weren't, in fact, in contravention of the treaty. However, it is interpreted by Israel, by Britain and France as a contravention of the terms of the treaty, all of which launch a counterattack, and soldiers are literally parachuted in by the tripartite aggression, as the three are known in Egyptian historiography. Britain, of course, already had its troops there, whereas the French and the Israelis had to be brought in. The confrontation escalates, and it is, in fact, the US that intervenes in the end to put an end to it.
There's a personal angle from your point of view, because you might not be here were it not for the Suez Crisis. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So my grandmother was studying child psychology in Geneva, and my grandfather was studying cardiology in Edinburgh. And they had both left Egypt just after 1952, after the coup, because it was understood that the kind of class that they came from was under threat by Nasser. So part of what Nasser's program was about, aside from his kind of international project, was also a project of social reform in Egypt, and particularly of land reform. And both of my grandparents came from land-owning families, felt threatened somewhat by the coup, although they had a very ambivalent relationship to Nasserism. My great-grandfather, my grandmother's father, was Prince Regent in 1952, so he was brought into power by the Free Officers to be regent alongside two others over the infant child king before Egypt was declared a republic. So he was in some ways sympathetic to the republican tendencies of the Free Officers, and yet they weren't sure about how things would play out, so they sent their children off abroad. Now, both of my grandparents, and I think this is testimony to the popularity of the nationalization of the canal, the people who felt very ambivalent about Nasser from the start returned in great numbers to volunteer in the war effort. And both of my grandparents met. They met as volunteers. He was running one of the military hospitals. She was a nurse. And she telephoned a few days after meeting him. She telephoned her mother. His surname meant lion in Arabic. And because the phones were tapped, she said, "I've met a lion and I'm going to marry him." And indeed, after the crisis ended, they married in early 1957. And yeah, so I am the consequence or a consequence of the Suez Crisis.
And how did the Suez Crisis, militarily, how did it end?
It was called off by the Americans. I mean, it was called off by the Americans. It was seen as humiliating for Britain to have been involved in something that looked like an anachronism. The Age of Empire was supposed to be over, and yet here was Britain behaving in this kind of anachronistic way. And however, in order to reopen the canal, so the canal is closed for roughly close to a year after the crisis into 57. However, in order to reopen the canal, UNF1, which is the UN volunteer force, is deployed to the Sinai, which is declared as a buffer zone. And it's the first time that the UN volunteers are deployed anywhere. And of course, this is subsequently becomes important in Irish history. But this is the first moment in which the UN peacekeeping forces are deployed anywhere. They are mostly Norwegians at that point. And they declare the canal a buffer zone. Now, from the perspective of Egypt, because they're occupying the Sinai, i.e. one side of the canal, this isn't seen as a fair buffer zone by Egypt, because it basically occupies a very large portion of its territory and doesn't allow it control over that very central waterway. So it's the eviction of UNF1 in later in the 60s, which ultimately then leads to the Six-Day War.
So in terms of British humiliation over Suez, and there's no doubt about it, it was a humiliating moment for empire. The British had long since been kicked out of Ireland. They had a decade beforehand been kicked out of India. Now they're kicked out of Suez. What impact, if any, did that have on then what happens with British colonies in Africa? Because one by one, these colonies are freed. Or would that have happened anyway?
I mean, it's certainly a very dramatic moment. And I think one of the things that I have always found very striking, of course, I mean, the next big moment happens in Aden in 1960. But of course, you're right. I mean, Mau Mau, etc. One of the things that I find so striking is the extent to which 1956 seems to be a turning point in the intellectual life of Britain itself, in the sense that so many central thinkers of Britain, whether on the left or on the right, talk about Suez as being a real turning point. So I suppose my answer to that question is, my sense was always that Suez was obviously very important for Egypt, but was also very important for Britain. It really reshapes the Britain that comes afterwards. Whether decolonization was by 56 inevitable or not is hard to answer, but there's no doubt that the Suez Crisis accelerated what was a process that was underway, and did so in very spectacular terms.
Well, my guest was Dr. Hossein Omar, lecturer in modern global history at University College Dublin. Hossein, thank you very much indeed for talking to us about the Suez Crisis on The History Show.
Thank you.
After the break, I'll be joined by archivist Elizabeth McAvoy to talk about the Famine Archive Collection, the Distress Papers.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. During the Great Famine, there was a severe strain on the administration of the time and on the government agencies tasked with alleviating mass starvation and disease. The Chief Secretary's Office, the Poor Law Commission, the Relief Commission and the Office of Public Works, all of them generated a huge quantity of records, records which are held today in the National Archives of Ireland. We're going to look now at one archive collection known as the Distress Papers, which give us a glimpse of the people and the stories behind the grim famine statistics. The collection is being featured at the moment at rte.ie/history. To talk about it, I'm joined by Elizabeth McAvoy of the National Archives. Elizabeth, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you very much, Miles, and many thanks for the invitation.
Tell us, first of all, what exactly were the distress papers and how and when did they come into being?
The distress papers form a distinct sub-series within a collection that is known as the Chief Secretary's Office Registered Papers. So they're the records of the Chief Secretary, who was based in Dublin Castle, and while nominally subject to the Lord Lieutenant, who was the King or Queen's representative in Ireland, the real work of administering and governing Ireland at that time and throughout the 19th century was actually done by the Chief Secretary himself and his Undersecretary, who were based in Dublin Castle. So the records that were generated in terms of administering the country, the CSORP collection begins in 1818 and runs up until the early 1920s. And it is an absolutely wonderful collection of administrative records, giving a very complete picture of Ireland and how it was governed in the 19th century and into the early 20th. And the distress papers form, as I mentioned, a very distinct or separate series within the CSORP, the Chief Secretary's Office Registered Papers. And they came about for a very specific reason, or came into being in March 1846, because a bureaucratic attempt was needed to manage or organise the avalanche of pleas that were coming in for aid all around the country, from the areas that were being particularly ravaged by the famine at that time.
So I suppose it would be fair to say that administrators, that bureaucrats, were absolutely snowed under with these what are called memorials. We'll talk about memorials in a while. So they needed to kind of separate these papers out into a separate category.
Exactly. They needed really to get a grip or a steer on these records, because obviously the situation was of immense urgency and they needed to be able to respond quickly. So rather than floundering in a sea of memorials, reports, letters and so on as part of the main series, they needed to separate them to be able to treat them differently.
Now, I know they're called the Chief Secretary's Registered Papers, and anybody who's ever been in the National Archives will be familiar with the index, these beautiful big volumes where you can actually increase your muscle mass just by taking one down off the shelf.
That's
they're
true.
Absolutely huge. They're extraordinary, but they're beautiful indexes. But would the Chief Secretary himself actually have seen any of these memorials, any of these distress papers, any of this material coming in? Or would that all have been dealt with by civil servants, by the undersecretary, for example?
Well, the undersecretary and certainly the staff in Dublin Castle would, of course, have been tasked with responding to the pleas. But the Chief Secretary would have been made aware of exactly what was going on, because the letters are often addressed to the Lord Lieutenant, of whom really the responsibility had been delegated to the Chief Secretary, but they were written nominally to the Lord Lieutenant. So yes, he would have been aware, the Chief Secretary would have been very much aware of what was coming in, because for the very reason, this is a situation where Ireland is plunged into an absolute catastrophe. So while the responses and, in a sense, the heavy lifting would have been done by the bureaucrats, the administrators and the local relief committees around the country, the Chief Secretary would have been very much aware of what was going on. He wouldn't have been able to avoid it.
What kind of documents were in the distress papers? You've mentioned memorials, for example. What was a memorial?
A memorial is a 19th century word, really, that we would use for petition nowadays. Petitions that would be got up online where people sign in, very similar where you would have had letters. Petitions imploring, pleading for aid, which would be signed by members of, for example, the local relief committees, local clergymen, local grandees, constabulary, justices of the peace and so on. So it's really another word for petition.
And the distress papers, they wouldn't just have been memorials. Is there lots of other material in there?
Plenty of other material. And while their content tends to be routine for this particular period, the type of documents that you would expect to find would be, of course, reports on the extent of distress from around the country, letters relating to the establishment of relief committees, applications for funds granted under famine relief legislation, letters from the Treasury concerning the spending of funds, and also correspondence from the other agencies who were also tasked with alleviating distress. So examples of those would have been the Famine Relief Commission, the Office of Public Works, and the Poor Law Commission. So you had a number of very large organisations, all of whom were dedicated to alleviating the stress from around the country. And the distress papers are a reflection of that, but we also have those type of letters generated by the OPW, the Famine Relief Commission, and the Poor Law. So you had a number of agencies working in tandem with each other.
Now, you've chosen a few extracts, a few documents, three documents in all, for us to have a look at, which show the effect of the famine on ordinary people around the country. One thing that struck me just looking at them straight away was how beautiful the calligraphy is. Belies, if you like, the nature of the content. All of the records you've chosen are from 1846, which was a particularly bad year. Three quarters of the harvest was lost to blight. It was the first really serious year of the famine. Now, the first memorial is from resident cottiers. Those are rural labourers who were let land in very, very small amounts. And this is from Killard in County Clare. Tell me about this.
Yes, it is a memorial or a petition from these very, very small land tenants who were writing in to the Lord Lieutenant in April 1846. And they describe their plight. They say, from swampy state of soil, they have lost all their potato crop and are now the most miserable beings. They await the opening of a public works scheme, a road which had already been sanctioned, which has been delayed. So they say they have been obliged to pawn their day and night covering to provide food and are now suffering from cold and hunger, too much for human endurance. And they ended with, praise their excellency will consider their wretched condition.
The next document you're going to talk about, actually by coincidence, and there's no collusion involved here, but it comes from the town in which I was born, in Kingscourt in County Cavan. And it's a letter from the Relief Committee, which essentially shows a landed class which was pretty much indifferent to the plight of their tenants.
Yes, it certainly does that particular class no favours in terms of what they write. Because local relief committees were financed by local voluntary subscriptions, and they could apply to the Lord Lieutenant for grants in proportion to the money subscribed locally. But unless the local grandees really subscribed, it was very, very difficult to actually operate the local committee. And it got to the stage where the Relief Commission actually instructed local committees to publish their subscription lists so as to discourage non-compliance. So in other words, an early example of naming and shaming them in to contributing. It was a very difficult task to raise the funds. And in this particular example, the committee lays bare its frustration with the landed class. They say, memorialists, conscious of the government's anxious desire to meet the wants of the poor throughout the land, and feeling that it is the duty of the landed proprietors to cooperate with the government on their benevolent exertions, forwarded circulars to 30 landed proprietors connected with their extensive parish, requesting contributions to their relief fund, but are sorry to state that only 3 responded to their applications and that the others have not even answered. So out of 30 circulars, requests for subscriptions, only three in that area of King's Court responded. So you had 27 people who ignored it. And of course, that wasn't unique to King's Court. That was happening all over the country as well.
Now, the final document you picked out is a memorial from tenants in Athenry in County Galway. Presumably they're experiencing the same problems as everybody else.
Yes, in common really with the absolutely calamitous situation and the wretched conditions that many people were forced to live in all along the Western seaboard. Again, similar to Killard, they're saying the potato rot, depriving them of all means of support. Their distress is too great for human endurance. Their appeal is for immediate relief, as they have not even a day's provisions for themselves or their starving families. If relief is not sent, their sufferings will be too awful to contemplate. So again, giving us an insight into and giving a voice in many respects to the poor and to the dying, who usually do not appear in administrative records of the time as a matter of course.
Now, obviously, in the National Archives, you're well used to digitization. We are entirely grateful to our own National Archives for example, the 1901 and 1911 census, those brilliant digitization projects. How difficult a project and how extensive a project has this one been, the distress papers?
It was a considerable project because, like with many projects in many organisations, it is the work of a number of people, of divisions within the organisation, who work together to deliver a result. The digitisation of the distress papers for the RTE project is no exception in that regard. Huge credit goes to our senior conservator, Zoe Reid, for conserving the documents prior to digitisation, ensuring obviously that they have been fully conserved and repaired and are ready for digitisation. And also credit enormously to my colleagues in our reprographics unit, who did a wonderful job of digitising the selection, which have been released already on the Famine website since early March. Particular thanks to Hazel Menton, Alina Saronin, Patricia Fallon and Hannah Sheeran for their expertise and also for assisting me with my preparations for today's interview.
Well, it's well worth looking at these. They're absolutely beautiful looking documents. And as I say, they belie incredibly the distress inherent in the documents themselves. Thank you very much for bringing those just a few stories revealed in this extraordinary archive collection. You can find more stories and information about different aspects of the Great Famine online at rte.ie/history on the Famine Ireland page, a selection of records from the Chief Secretary's Office registered papers for the years 1818 to 1852 can be searched and viewed on the National Archives website. Elizabeth McAvoy is an archivist with the National Archives. Elizabeth, many thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you very, very much, Miles.
After the break, I'll be joined by Jupp Learson, editor of the new book, Parnell and His Times.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. A major new book on the 19th century nationalist leader and parliamentarian Charles Stewart Parnell casts fresh light on his impact on Ireland. The editor is Professor Jupp Learson of the University of Amsterdam. Jupp, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you.
I suppose the first question is, a lot has been written about Charles Stewart Parnell. Why do we need more?
Yes, we are coming out of a decade of centenary commemorations. And I think this is a good moment as the centenary clock ticks over from Ireland pre-independence to Ireland in independence, to take the helicopter view and to see what deeper force lines were at work. And what were the reasons behind, if you like, a certain amount of disunity in Ireland between the rural West, the Protestant industrial North, and middle-class Dublin, and how Ireland had been prepared for this crisis in its existence. And we felt that there, The figure of Parnell turned out to throw a major shadow across the year 1900.
Absolutely. Now, in the book, the second half of the book, I think you could say, looks at the legacy of Parnell and the undigested memory of his defeat and his death. But let's start with the first part of the book. The first essay is by the late Oliver McDonough. It's titled O'Connell and Parnell. To what extent did Parnell kind of cast back to the political life, the failures and the successes of Daniel O'Connell, and take example from those?
I think Parnell would have been unthinkable without O'Connell, and I think he was aware of it. Of course, there are major differences between this Protestant Wicklow landlord and the Catholic Kerry squire. O'Connell was working before the empowerment of an Irish middle class. He was working before Catholic emancipation. What he invented, however, almost like a precursor of Martin Luther King, was the force of an extra-parliamentary popular opposition to injustice. So the mass rallies that O'Connell organized, mobilizing the power of the disenfranchised, was a totally new strategy in the political toolkit. And Parnell, although he came from a politically entitled class, still relied on this very, very heavily. His main career was being a conduit between the Land League and Westminster, and in forging a bond between the agricultural part of the Irish economy and the political representation in Westminster. So like O'Connell, Parnell was to some extent a populist, somebody who marshalled public opinion against the political powers that be. And so for all their differences, they really stand in an almost filial relationship.
What emerges from Raymond Gillespie's essay in the book is that Parnell didn't harbour particularly fervent religious convictions. Was that a help or was it a hindrance in the politics of his day?
I think it was both. Religious convictions were a fraught element in the politics of the time, one way or the other, whether you bought into them or whether you were heedless of them. Politics in many European countries were subject to the forces of confessionalization. And Raymond Gillespie's article shows that, of course, there was a huge palette of different Protestant denominations where the smaller denominations were much more fervent than the complacent Anglican Church of Ireland classes that Parnell would come from. And this, of course, came back to haunt Irish politics after Carson, when it was precisely those more Presbyterian religious forces in the north which became the greatest obstacle to a Parnellite vision of home rule. So Parnell himself, I think, was very keen on uniting national opposition, both drawing on Catholic, you know, farmers and on the Church of Ireland middle classes of Dublin, but he couldn't span the entire breadth and width of the confessional landscape in Ireland. And that was perhaps also the reason why his agenda ultimately had to fail.
Had he paid perhaps more heed to religion, might he have been able to read the room, as it were, a little bit better in 1890 when it came to assessing the impact of the O'Shea divorce on the one hand on the Roman Catholic Irish hierarchy and the supporters of the Irish Parliamentary Party, and on the other hand, the nonconformist conscience in England, which Gladstone had to obviously take cognizance of.
Absolutely. I think Parnell failed to read the room, and I think he was unduly optimistic that by force of personality and by force of his charisma, he would be able to ride out this problematics. I think what he underestimated was that the late 19th century was very moralistic. And whether your morality came from Pius IX and from the Catholic Church, or whether it came from evangelical Protestantism or nonconformist Protestantism, is almost immaterial. The idea that Parnell could brass out not only the fact that he'd had an extramarital affair, but that he tried then to do the cuckolded husband, Captain O'Shea, a favour within his political party, and that he could somehow bring this off, was, I think, a disastrous misreading of the extent to which moralism was still applied, even to charismatic leaders.
One of the things that's always puzzled me about Parnell is that at the end of his career, when he's in dire straits, when he's clutching at any straw that passes, he seems in his speeches to become if you like, more republican. He seems to be reverting to the kind of proto-Fenianism or quasi-Fenianism of the early part of his career when he was involved in the obstruction movement. Is that actually happening, or is he being completely cynical? Is he just looking for a constituency that will save him, perhaps?
That's a very interesting question. My own interpretation would be that in his dire straits and in the fraught situation of the party political situation in which he finds himself, he is trying to mobilize the future. And that makes him very different from Irish politics until that moment, which had always been about mobilizing the past, which is what O'Connell had still done, to look at history as a trajectory of injustice that had to be remedied. Parnell has a sort of yes, we can, a future orientation. And I think he is trying to recall that idea that you need me to get there. The future is beyond the present quandary and the present vituperation, which is how probably why he goes back to a more republican or, if you like, future-oriented way of phrasing his politics. And interestingly enough, that then is also provides the phraseology which he has bequeathed to subsequent republicanism. So this is the Parnell who, at the end of his life, is remembered by the more radical political successors.
Because oddly, at the same time, he also appears to be reaching out to unionists in the same way, at the same time as he's reaching out to Fenians. I mean, that seems to be utterly contradictory. So it does suggest somebody who's floundering. But, you know, that's not what I'm getting from you.
Well, I don't think Parnell was never prone to panic. He was a very strong personality. But I do think, indeed, that eventually what he came to grief about was his inability to keep all these different interest groups of Irish society together. He might have a vision of home rule, he might have a vision of empowerment, but whether that applied to the labourer breaking stones, as in Yeats's poem, or the peasantry of the west of Ireland, or the industrial north, eventually he could not hold that together. And certainly not when he lost the charisma over a moralistic, you know, peccadillo.
Now, obviously, as I said, the second half of the book relates to the legacy. One of the legacies, presumably, is that with him gone, the fault lines which were inherent in the party that he led now become more obvious. And aside from the obvious split that takes place between pro-Parnellites and anti-Parnellites, there are other schisms, there are other splits. Does that suggest that it was merely the power of his personality that was keeping this rather disparate party together?
Towards the end it was. And I think that's also why we see such incredible disarray after his very speedy downfall and death. So Parnell is like a crater. He's like a ground zero. He is something hollow in the middle of debris and rubble, and it explodes into all directions. So, yeah, with Parnell gone, the one possible formula that could unite a number of aspirations, which were always difficult to reconcile, is gone. Of course, politics is always about reconciling different interest groups. And, you know, nobody is ever in complete unison. But the basis on which you might negotiate or thresh out those differences was gone with the, not with Parnell himself, but with the charisma of Parnell. Parnell gave people a reason to believe, which is what charisma is. It's not really an agenda. It's just, you know, the warmth that you inspire and the sense of hope and feasibility in your audience.
Again, the second half of the book deals also with an imagined Parnell, the imagined Parnell of James Joyce, the imagined Parnell of W.B. Yeats. To what extent do we have we inherited an imagined Parnell to this day, as opposed to an actual Parnell who was apparently or allegedly kinder to his dogs than he was to his parliamentary colleagues?
Parnell always had a larger than life reputation. There was a definite hero worship going on around him while he was riding the crest of his wave. He was already casting a very, very big projection onto the landscape. And if you had looked at the private man, you might have seen somebody who was smaller than the shadows that he threw. This became magnified even further in the cultural echo chamber of Ireland between 1890 and 1920, that here Parnell just was reverberating, being recycled, and where his absence was always seen as the main thing that was lacking in Irish life, the decenteredness of Irish life. So Joyce and Yeats and the sense of this uncanny idea that whenever there's a glimmer of hope in Ireland, eventually we slide back and it all comes to grief again, and there's yet another tragic hero who failed to deliver us. That uncanny repetition, after all the failed martyred heroes, now there's Parnell gone, that really magnified and amplified. It's almost impossible to get at the real Parnell at this stage. I mean, he's overlaid by so many echoes and so many projections.
Let me ask you, in conclusion, the obvious counterfactual part, the inevitable, I suppose, counterfactual Parnell question. If he hadn't fallen from grace and then died rapidly, so obviously there was no possibility of a comeback, would do you think he have gone on to render the Sinn Féin of the early 1900s, Arthur Griffith's Sinn Féin, stillborn and redundant? Or would he have, as was often his wont, would he have got bored with the chase and would he have gone back to the Wicklow estate and played cricket a lot?
I think that it's a very intriguing and exciting hypothesis to ponder. The Parnell would eventually have left politics. And as we know, almost every political career ends in disenchantment. Most people withdraw from politics because they end in failure one way or the other. Very few people retire triumphantly, as Nelson Mandela would. So Parnell did not get into that Gandhi or Mandela stature. If he had not fallen, I think there would have been a stronger parliamentary platform to debate the relationship between Ireland and the Empire. And the nationalist voice in Irish affairs would not have been left exclusively to the cultural Irish Irelanders and Fenians, so that possibly in the context of the Wilsonian 14 Points Programme and Versailles, a more peaceful solution within parliamentary political terms without civil war might have been achieved. Whether or not that would have included the North is anybody's guess, but I think the Irish politics would have been less violent if Parnell had not fallen.
The book is called Parnell and His Times, includes contributions from the likes of Paul Bew, Frank McGuinness, Declan Kybert, Claire Connolly, Tom Bartlett, Claire Wills and others. Jupp Learson, thank you very much indeed for talking to us and joining us on the History Show this evening.
Thanks very much, Miles.
Very quickly before we go, Anyone for Tennis? That's the title of an online talk taking place this Wednesday, the 7th of April at 8 p.m. on the tennis craze that swept through turn of the century Dublin. To join local historian John O'Brien on Zoom that evening, you can register details by emailing info@stratfordtennis.ie. We put the details on our website. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. Our researcher is Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Logan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.